Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You can say this about low interest rates. They have made certain parts of this economy boring again. Not that that's a bad thing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, the 19th of September. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. In the land of economic news this week, Janet Yellen is queen. Not to be clear, because the Fed is likely to raise rates after its two-day meeting wraps up tomorrow and Wednesday. It's not, just a hint. But it is because of how those low interest rates continue to play out throughout this economy. What some might call a boring area of the stock market is having quite a year. Talking about income stocks here, typically less flashy companies that do things like provide electricity and sell paper towels. They don't get all the buzz of, say, the flashy new tech companies, but what they do is pay steady and consistent dividends. And right now, stocks like that are much in demand because, follow the chain here, of the Fed. From New York, Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains.
Quick refresher if you need it. There are a couple ways a stock can make you money. It can go up in value, and it can pay you quarterly dividends, a share of profits the company pays out to shareholders. That regular income stream makes those stocks really attractive right now.
Interest rates in the bond market are relatively low, and so I think people are looking for an alternative.
Former Fed economist Ann Owen is a professor at Hamilton College.
These type of stocks that generate consistent dividends are an alternative.
Older investors in particular count on bonds for income. Frustration with low yields pushed them towards investments offering rich dividends. Thomson Reuters Lipper data show funds focused on income stocks with net inflows of nearly $10.2 billion through mid-September of this year. But a move away from safer bonds means trade-offs. Daniel Egan is director of behavioral finance and investing at Betterment.
It's an attempt to feel safe because you've got these flows of income coming in while actually exposing yourself to more risk.
Like a drop in value. And there are some signs the big run for these income stocks won't last. Tom Rosine heads research services at Lipper.
Because so many people have been flocking towards these dividend payers, they are actually have been bid up and have become a little bit rich in price. And I think that's concerned a lot of investors as well.
Big price drops in these stocks could wallop investors who've been chasing those meaty dividends. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The governors of Alabama, Georgia, and Tennessee have declared states of emergency this week. Not tornadoes or hurricanes, but gasoline. A 50-plus-year-old gasoline pipeline in Alabama has sprung a leak, shutting down gas deliveries to parts of the East Coast, farther east and north. Shortages are happening, prices are going up, and we are all realizing anew that gas doesn't magically appear out of the end of the hose when you pull up to the pump. It has to get there from refineries somehow, right? Marketplace's Jed Kim explains there are a whole lot of disconnects when it comes to pipelines right now.
The first disconnect is physical. As a result of the shutdown, some areas of the southeast U.S. are seeing less gas. Mike Thornbrew is a spokesman for Quick Trip. He says his company is picking which stations will get deliveries.
As supply hopefully gets better, we'll start putting more and more stores into that category. But at this point, we're still running on about 50% capacity.
The Colonial pipelines normally carry about 2.5 million barrels a day. About half that capacity is gone. Colonial isn't giving interviews, but has said on an informational site that it expects the line to be back up sometime this week. Thornbrew says in the meantime, Quick Trip is looking into barges, train cars, interstate trucking as possible ways to keep it flowing.
It's just another reminder just how critical the infrastructure is in the United States. And all it takes is one pipeline to really create a lot of havoc and to the marketplace.
That vulnerability may be getting exacerbated by the controversy over the Dakota Access Pipeline more than 1,000 miles away.
Well, you certainly can't build any new infrastructure because people are protesting against it.
Barbara Shook is with Energy Intelligence.
A lot of our infrastructure is old, and getting it repaired is difficult because you have so many protesters who just want us to abandon all our infrastructure, and I guess we're supposed to walk from Texas to New York now.
She says some pipeline disconnects are physical, others more cognitive. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Oil, as long as we're on petrochemicals, closed up about 1% or so in New York today, $43.40 a gallon. There's renewed talk of a production freeze from some OPEC countries. Talk that I'm obliged to remind you we have heard before. Elsewhere in the capital markets, whole lot of nothing going on in stocks, waiting for Yellen, they are. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We did an interview a couple of years ago with a woman named Katrina Lake, who had founded the online personal styling service Stitch Fix. It was, at the time, geared entirely toward women and female clothing. So I asked the obvious question, what about, you know, me?
We hear a lot from Stitch Fix husbands who would love to have the service for men as well. At this point right now, we're really just focusing on scaling our women's business and growing our women's business.
Lo and behold, 2 years on, Stitch Fix Men is upon us. Mike Smith runs it. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
All right, so I'm going to stereotype here, and there will be those in the audience who disagree, but there is some grain of truth to this. And in fact, Katrina talked about it when we spoke a couple of years ago. Guys, a lot of guys, not all, but a lot of guys, are good with big T-shirts and cargo shorts. How do you get them to sign up for your product?
Well, I think I'm a good story around that, and I was that guy with T-shirts and big cargo pants, and I think lacked in style, and I've evolved my style in working at Stitch Fix. And I think when guys get exposed to great denim or a great new brand or a great new shirt, they really gain confidence in their style. And that's what we're trying to do at Stitch Fix, is evolve a man's style and get them confident with what they're wearing every day.
All right, so don't take this the wrong way, but what are you wearing?
Today, I'm wearing one of our exclusive brand Hawker Rye shirts.
All right.
And I'm wearing some Mavi jeans. And 4 years ago, you wouldn't have found me in either of those pieces of clothing. So I'm excited to be wearing it.
All right. So now that I've gotten more personal than really either of us cares to get, let me take it back to where it needs to be, which is
sounds good.
You used to be running Walmart.com, which is, without any disparagement towards Stitch Fix, quite the larger enterprise. What is it about this space that made you, as a combination tech guy and retailer and sort of an entrepreneur, what made this attractive?
I think it was the idea of being disruptive in retail and marrying the art of marrying the balance between art and science. I think at my old company, we talked a lot about data, and we were really good at understanding transactions, things mm-hmm. that would happen at the point of sale system, but we didn't understand the customer. And I was excited to serve a specific customer in a very personalized way.
Well, you know, so she brought this up actually when we spoke, Katrina did, and I guess it bears repeating. There's a huge element of big data and algorithms to how you do what you do. Run us through that.
Yeah, the way it works is that we have the algorithm that runs against the existing inventory after a client has filled out a style profile. But then we have a stylist, a human, that picks the last five things that go in a fix. And we believe strongly that the balance between that science that helps us kind of curate the inventory better and the human that picks the last five things is the way to serve that client. And the client cares a lot about the relationship with the stylist. They don't care as much about the relationship with the algorithm. And we're happy to have the stylist be the one that has the relationship with the client.
Should I choose to trade in my cargo shorts and my big T-shirts, which, full disclosure, I don't actually wear, but metaphorically speaking, should I choose to do that, how much is this going to cost me?
The average price point for men today on our platform is about $55 or $60 per item. I think the thing that we're most proud of and what we plan on doing and serving, just like we do in the women's business today, is a very wide range of price points and styles. And that's why we think it's going to be a very big business and one of the most exciting things you'll see in menswear in the next few years.
Brown suede shoes, blue Ben Sherman pants, and a purple crew neck sweater for me today.
Okay, sounds good. We'll get you signed up.
Mike Smith is the GM of Stitch Fix Men. Mike, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
We do a thing here every now and then where you ask the questions, we answer them, stuff that's been bugging you about business and the economy. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Today, bargains, big bargains at those dollar stores. The big ones nationally are Dollar Tree and Dollar General. They were hot right after the recession, but have started fading a bit as mainstream discounters like Walmart make a play for the deep discount business. So our listener question that we got went something like this. How do the dollar stores keep their prices so low? From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on this one.
So I kind of can't resist. I got to go for Swiss rolls, chocolate cake with a cream swirl inside. I'm going to get my Sharpie pen as well, which is always useful.
I'm at a Dollar Tree store on the outskirts of Portland. It's on a rundown commercial strip. Plenty of parking, though, in front of this no-frills storefront that stocks the basics. Soda, canned goods, school supplies.
All right, $2. Music. Thank you.
That's right, two items for $2. Virtually everything's a dollar here. Which prompts this from listener Dore Sitko of Austin, Texas.
A lot of the products that I was purchasing for a dollar years ago, I'm still purchasing today. And I wonder how they can maintain that dollar price point.
Now, prices at the consumer level have been rising at about 1.7% a year for the past decade. Plug that into the government's consumer price inflation calculator, and what cost you a dollar back in 2006 will cost $1.19 today. Except it would appear if you shop at the dollar stores. I put in a call to the Dollar Tree to ask how they've kept every price in the store fixed at a dollar in the face of inflation. They didn't respond. And Dollar General wrote back that it is dedicated to the affordability needs of its customers and said that it prices more than 80% of items at $5 or less, but didn't elaborate. So I asked Mark Cohen, director of retail studies at Columbia Business School.
This channel has the benefit of hardwired price points to be able to negotiate.
Basically, Cohen says, the dollar chains use their leverage as huge purchasers of bulk goods to say to suppliers, here's what we'll pay you so we can keep our retail price at a dollar. But why would the Gatorades and Welch's and off-brand labels of the world play ball?
They use different math than they would use for their more traditional retail customers.
The low price that suppliers get may not pencil out so badly if they're clearing out old inventory or packaging that doesn't look good enough for, say, Walmart. Selling that product to a dollar chain, even at a tiny margin, is better than throwing it out.
There's always going to be excess supply or distressed goods which somehow went bump in the night. If it's cheap enough, these stores don't care if the yellow is three shades off of what was originally ordered.
Also, keep in mind, the dollar stores sell plenty of stuff, like clothes and household goods, that have actually gotten cheaper over time as production has shifted to lower-cost factories overseas. Finally, if all else fails, says economist Mark Cooperberg at Swarthmore College, discounters can always shave the quantity or quality of an item just a bit to keep the price on the package constant.
Now, these are the famous cases of when there were price controls. So a pack of cigarettes would have X price, but then people would make the cigarettes smaller. You know, so there's ways in which you can maintain a price of a dollar, but it's actually not the same product any longer.
Now, keeping prices at a dollar could get harder, says Cohen, if inflation gets out of control.
If inflation were to become rampant, the dollar stores might have to become $2 stores.
But don't worry too much for the super discount retailers, he says. Bargain-loving consumers will still shop at a $2 store before spending $2.50 at Target or Walmart. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
baby boomers have been retiring later in life.
Bad for the boomers, possibly, but good for the economy, perhaps? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down just 3 points today, less than a 10%, 18,120. The NASDAQ down 9 points, about a 10%, 5,235. The S&P 500 also meh. In fact, unchanged, 2139. Tomorrow is the beginning of the Fed September meeting, the will she or won't she interest rates meeting. The answer is she won't. Banks got a slight boost. Seems most people, like me, are not betting on rates moving much. Bank of America ended up 0.6%. Citigroup up almost 0.4%. A good day for Sarepta Therapeutics, maker of a drug for a rare type of muscular dystrophy. The FDA gave the drug accelerated approval. Shares at one point up almost 90%, 90%, before settling back to close a mere 74% higher. And you are listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The Emmys were on ABC last night, but other than that, the traditional broadcast networks didn't have all that much to do with the awards show. HBO and FX won 6 times, Netflix 3, Amazon twice. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganzer has more now on the new things in television content.
Exhibit A, the Amazon show Transparent, about a family and what happens after their father comes out as transgender. Show creator Jill Soloway won an Emmy last night. In her acceptance speech, she didn't thank her agent or her family. She gave a shout out to the CEO of Amazon, Jeff Bezos.
So I want to thank you, my sweet Jeff Bezos, because you changed the world.
How? Money makes the world go around, and Amazon, Netflix, and HBO have plenty of it.
Netflix has a $6 billion content budget.
That's John Carroll. He teaches mass communication at Boston University.
Amazon has a $2 billion, about the same as HBO.
The newcomers are bidding up the price of the high-quality, unique TV shows and movies they crave. They know exactly what they want, thanks to you. Yes, you. The audience. Dan Cryan is with IHS Market.
The company knows what titles it is that you're watching, and can use that data to take a view on what sort of content you're likely to watch.
And that's the stuff it buys.
You know, I would venture to say things like horror movies, things like, you know, independent movies.
Ricard Gill teaches economics and strategy at Johns Hopkins. He says Jeff Bezos is also changing the distribution of movies and TV, along with Netflix and HBO. In many cases, they're just buying a movie script, making it themselves, and then just streaming it, avoiding theaters altogether. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We talked to Roy Price, the head of Amazon Studios, a couple of years ago on this program, just as Transparent was set to launch, as it happens. It's on our website, of course, marketplace.org. The UN General Assembly is meeting in New York this week. VIP traffic jams adding to the chaos that is Manhattan. British Prime Minister Theresa May is going to be in town, and she's going to take advantage of that gathering to work on that other thing she is dealing with back home, Brexit. May is going to meet with, among others, executives at Goldman Sachs, IBM, Amazon, and a bunch of others to talk about their continued investment in a post-EU UK. She's got plenty of time. May has said the formal 2-year process to leave the EU isn't going to start before the end of this year, at the very earliest. The number of senior citizens in this country is expected to basically double over the next 30 years or so. 48 million today, 88 million to 2050. An aging population is not, generally speaking, considered to be an overall positive for an economy. Fewer workers to support all those retirees, among other things. But as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, it may not be quite as dire as we have been led to believe.
Although the U.S. population's getting older, compared to our main economic partners in Europe and Asia, we're getting older less quickly, mainly because we have more babies and more immigrants.
And that is replenishing the working age population and also helping hold up the birth rate in the United States.
Gary Bertels is an economist at the Brookings Institution.
The second thing is that baby boomers have been retiring later in life.
This is important because in addition to making things, workers also pay taxes, which go into services for seniors. In fact, economists have a statistic for measuring this. It's called the old age dependency ratio. Quite simply, the number of retirees as a percentage of the number of workers. However, the stat assumes everyone is retired at 65.
There's no magic to 65.
Warren Sanderson is an economist at Stony Brook University. The problem, he says, is that 65 isn't that old anymore.
In 2050, people 65 years and older are going to be much healthier, more cognitively able.
And even when the baby boomers retire, they'll still contribute to the economy. So says Michael Giandria, a research economist at the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
They continue to go to the market and buy food and groceries, and they continue to go to movies and travel and go on vacations.
So, perhaps instead of worrying about what will happen when the boomers finally do retire, we should all invest in what they buy now. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
We've done some stories the past couple of years about China starting to look overseas for natural resources, one of the side effects of having to feed, clothe, and house 1.3 billion people. Up till now, those stories have been mostly filed from places in Africa and South America. Today, John Lawrenson takes us to central France, the heart of the French grain economy.
À partir de maintenant, tout ce qui est à gauche et à droite,
driving down a country lane through what the poet Peggy, writing about this part of France, described as oceans of wheat. The man at the wheel is the farmer and local farmers' union leader, Hervé Coupeau. From here, everything you see on the right and on the left belongs to the Chinese, he tells me.
So this is the farmhouse where the farmer used to live, right?
Oui.
Who's working this farm now? Qui travaille maintenant alors?
Casual
labor. They hire people for a month or two. The rest of the year, there's no one. It's empty. With normal owners, as it were, you'd have a family with children in the local school, a farmer's wife who'd stay on the farm or go out to work. Whichever way, there'd be life. Here, there's nobody.
A company called Hong Yang purchased this and several other farms, acquiring 5,200 acres so far, wheat, barley and rapeseed mainly. Coupeau says they paid over twice the market price. Locals say that after each purchase, a group of Chinese investors comes to see what they've bought. Then they eat at a local restaurant and return to China. The apparent unwillingness of the buyers to explain who they are and what they're about has upped anxiety among farmers. Arnaud Morin, feeding his 80 black-faced Suffolk sheep. He also raises cattle and grows wheat.
I lease 95% of the land I farm. If one of the owners decided to sell, I wouldn't be able to afford to buy because the Chinese have pushed the price up so much. It's the same for young farmers starting up. They can no longer afford to buy land, and I don't like our land going to foreigners. The land is like our soul.
China is investing heavily in Europe, $23 billion last year compared with $15 billion of Chinese investments in the US. And it's not the first time China has displayed interest in French agriculture. Antoine Brunet is a retired economic advisor to the HSBC Bank and author of China's Strategy to Rule the World.
Les Chinois, par exemple, avaient acheté beaucoup de vignobles dans le Bordelais.
The Chinese had bought a lot of vineyards in the Bordeaux area and in the dairy sector. They bought a 20% stake in a big dairy cooperative in Normandy, which means, indirectly, they part-own the land. They know in the future that China will need to source a lot of food abroad, so they have started to do what they have already done in other places. In Africa and Latin America, they have even brought in their own farm laborers to work the land they've bought.
Y'a quelqu'un?
Back in the Berry, I visit a second, then a third farm sold to the Chinese. Lots of shiny machinery, not a soul. At the last one, there are still curtains on the farmhouse windows. But this is the only inhabitant I meet.
Ah. Well, you're quite sweet.
Local attorneys here have told Coupeau that the Chinese plan to ultimately buy 50,000 acres. If they do that, he says, they'll be able to fill a freight train with the harvest and ship it to China. In the Berry, central France, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a sidebar to the bombings in New York and New Jersey over the weekend. You've seen the reports by now, I'm sure, about a lot of New Yorkers getting an emergency alert on their phones this morning, telling them to be on the lookout for Ahmad Rahami. The folks at Quartz did some digging. Turns out there are three different kinds of alerts transmitted through what is called the Wireless Emergency Alerts System. Amber alerts about abducted kids, imminent threat alerts typically used for natural disasters, and then presidential alerts, which come directly from the president or his or her designee. Here's the interesting part. You can apparently change the settings in your phone to not get amber and imminent threat alerts. That presidential thing, though, you're going to get it whether you want it or not. Fed announcement on interest rates on Wednesday. That tells you all you need to know about Wall Street between now and then. The Dow barely changed, down just 3 points, less than a tenth percent. The NASDAQ down 9 points, about a tenth percent. S&P 500 almost completely flat. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Robert Gorova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.